Meet Reed Lance Rosenthal, rancher, number one best-selling award-winning author, and unabashedly, unapologetically, on the right side of the outstanding issues of our generation. But don't try to fence him in. Sometimes his positions will surprise you, because Reed is definitely his own man, with his own opinions. You might love him, you might hate him, but you won't be able to stop listening. Step over to the right side with Reed.
Happy Saturday, folks. It's Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. Another tumultuous week. I seem to say that every week. It just gets crazier and crazier. But that's good, because, you know, the left is getting outed for what they are and what they truly believe, which they've hidden for a long time from the American people. And we will hope that that the outing that's occurred is not too late for us to react and save those pillars of America they wish to destroy: faith, family, and the Constitution. I have so much to go over with you this morning. I don't even know where to start. I mean, my desk here is just a mess. It's a blizzard of paper. We're going to have a little story, because we always do. This one kind of in a historical Thanksgiving context. And let me apologize for not wishing all my great listeners around the country and around the world a happy Thanksgiving. Last week I was so revved up, I forgot. Hopefully our little postings on the website, which people really liked, I think it got 50 or 60 shares, something like that, on Facebook. Hopefully that made up for it. That atoned to some extent. And I hope you had the best Thanksgiving you've ever had. Great with family and friends and turkey and ham and whatever have you that you had on your table. I'm still munching on leftovers. I'm sure you are too. It's like a week's feast, right? And we're going to talk about today, we're going to be talking about voter fraud, because it is rampant. It is a threat to the Republic. And by the way, let me remind us all, we are not a democracy. The left loves to say democracy. Democracy is ruled by mob. A republic, a constitutional republic, is ruled by law. There's a really big difference. In a constitutional republic, the rights and views of the minority and the rights to express them, which the left is trying to extinguish, is protected. In a democracy, you know, it's just straight vote, shall we say. If you're on the losing side by one vote, you lose all. Not so in a constitutional republic. And that is a knife that cuts both ways, both left and right. One of the things that the left, of the many things they have targeted, are trying to revamp, shall we say. I don't know if you've heard, I'm gonna get off my little introduction to the show here for just a moment, but now there's a study by some professors. Oh, well, gee. Really? Liberal higher education doing a study on the Electoral College? What could go wrong? So they're suggesting that the Electoral College, particularly since, you know, Trump won and 65 million people voted for him. Of course, they don't count. They're deplorables and despicables. And, you know, they're all us bubbas out here who don't know squat. We just don't have the education. We don't have the elitist status. We just don't know from where we come or what we say. So they're proposing that the Electoral College... And remember, the left likes to eat institutions and ideas in bites. I have long talked about, you can go and type in Obama's czars, that's C-Z-A-R-S, in the search bar. You can listen to my shows. But he had a czar of regulation. I talked about him at some length, who wrote a book called Nudge. His wife, by the way, was Samantha Powers, the ambassador to the United Nations, who unmasked illegally 335 Americans running up to the 2016 election. But that's yet another tale. In any event, Cass Sunstein was this guy's name, and his book Nudge was about how the left would accomplish its goals one little push here, one little tug here, one little bite here. You know, they'd eat the elephant one tiny bite at a time, and nobody would notice until it's too late. And that's what the left does, folks. That's what they've always done. That's what they've done back since time immemorial. It's how Hitler did it. It's how Stalin did it. It's how Lenin did it. It's how Mayo did it. They all do it the same way. You know, it's the playbook, the Alinsky playbook. In any event, what these professors propose now, since they know they're not going to get the electoral system thrown out to begin with, although that's the end goal, what they have proposed is that the electoral system actually be modified so that percentages of states' votes would award the electoral votes under the Electoral College. And they argue that this would be highly beneficial to conservatives because, just think, in New York State, that million or so votes out of the 8 million cast are cast by folks in upstate New York who are conservative. And you'd get a few of their electoral votes. And then they argue the same for California. Of course, they neglect to mention that there are small minority left-leaning votes in states like Kansas and Nebraska. And, of course, Texas, which is really the peach they have their eye on, 38 electoral votes. They would like to block a Republican or conservative, who cares if it's Republican, president for, you know, a generation. And turning Texas blue, or even turning Texas partially blue, which is what this electoral system would do, would accomplish that goal. They leave that out of the study. Imagine that. Anyway, I haven't sat down and done the math, although I'm sure somebody will, because the left is suddenly touting this study as a wonderful way to compromise, to work across the aisle, to fine-tune our wonderful democracy. Beep. Republic. Left. Republic. Not democracy. So, I digressed, but a warning. I've told you for years that the left is all about whatever it takes to win. And along those lines, we're going to talk a little bit more about voter fraud this morning. I have some astonishing facts and figures for you on how much fraud there really was in Florida, how close they came to stealing both those elections, senatorial and gubernatorial, and they, in fact, did steal a number of elections, congressional and state office, like the Commissioner of Agriculture talked about that last week, who happens to control concealed carry permits. You know, it's a sideways segue by the left very cleverly into gun control in Florida. So we're going to be talking about that. We're going to talk about poor Hillary. Poor Hillary. Poor Hillary. Poor crooked Hillary. She got some very bad news in the last week. Federal judge said, nope, you're going to produce everything that you're supposed to produce in this lawsuit, darling. Which she's gotten out of course, with Comey, with her buddy Comey, and her buddy Obama, and her buddies in the State Department, and her cis buddy Uma. She's gotten out of that for years. She's escaped justice. I think the walls are closing in on poor Hillary, because this judge is no nonsense, and he said, you will produce this stuff. And it's about Benghazi. You know, I told you when Benghazi happened that I thought it was a huge, terrible, dark spot on the whole country, but and in many aspects. But to leave an entire CIA station, to leave eight brave men on a rooftop, four of whom, and in the consulate, four of whom died, was a crime. That Obama was on his way to a campaign rally in Nevada and couldn't be bothered, and that Hillary disappeared while her staff argued over should we or should we not send reinforcements, and should they or should they not have uniforms in the 13 hours, that's 13 hours, those men withstood an attack by hundreds of radical Muslims, is simply criminal. And then to lie about it with the video, Susan Rice on five TV shows. Oh, yes, well, it was the video that prompted it. I mean, you all remember that. But there's some emails now that have surfaced because of this judge's rulings, maybe part of the 33,000 that Hillary wiped after she received her subpoena, yet another felonious act. And I'm going to go over those with you this morning. They will make your blood boil. You know, we have heard much in the last week about how folks should be held accountable. Well, Hillary Clinton, along with Barack Obama, our buddy Barry, murdered those four people in Benghazi. They let them down on every single level. And one of the reasons Benghazi happened, and you'll see from these emails, is that the other side, that would be radical and extremist Muslims, which the State Department, supposedly, and Chris Stevens, our ambassador, and his security detail absolutely knew about, they gave away his position, his exact position, on the exact date, which is why the marauding hordes knew exactly where to go and when. And she gave away his position because she had an illegal server in her basement, which the FBI, even Comey's FBI, said has been hacked by five different state actors. And I guarantee you one of those state actors is Iran, who pulls the strings over there on what happens with radical Islam and attacks. It is truly outrageous, and I think you will be as outraged as I when I share them with you. And we're going to talk about it, and I promised you last week that we would. We're going to talk about the damages that the Jewish left in America due to America and to Israel. And we're going to talk a little bit about the history of the Jewish left. I think you'll find it fascinating. And before all you libs that listen to me because you hate me, before you jump up and down and go, oh man, anti-Semitic and blah, 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 let me remind you my last name is Rosenthal. And my great-grandparents died at Auschwitz. So don't give me your left-wing crap. Unlike you, I know what I'm talking about. All right, we're going to be talking about, also, we're going to be talking, yeah, well, I tell you, I got so much stuff to go over with you. Along those lines, we're going to be talking about the first female Muslim, elected to Congress in Minnesota. In fact, she took over Keith Ellison's seat. Remember Keith Ellison? You know, friend of the Muslim Brotherhood, congressional dude from Minnesota, co-chair of the Democratic National Committee, now accused, of course, the mainstream press isn't talking about it, of all sorts of sexual, domestic, and abuse of females, running for, and I believe lost, I hope lost, running for Attorney General of Minnesota. Well, this gal took over his seat. By the way, she took over a seat, ties right into the segment before it, with the help of Jewish voters in her district. And this story of this lady is instructive on a whole bunch of levels. Because she promised these voters who put her over the top certain positions relative to Israel, Palestine, etc. And the first thing she did, we're talking about within days, within 48 hours of her being elected, she reversed those positions, which is what the left does. We're going to be talking just a tad about gun control. I have a big gun control part of the show planned for next week. Don't miss it, because your Second Amendment rights are now at serious risk. You have no idea. I'm just going to give you a teaser on it today. We're going to be talking about, and I promised this last week too, last week I told you about what's happening 6 months ago, 9 months ago, I did a show. Six reasons why the value of your home is going to decline. And everybody jumped up and down, poo-poo, you're crazy, these markets are blah, 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 you know, the usual stuff. Well, here we are. And last week I brought to your attention what's happening in the Northeast. Sales are down 50%, actually 50.1%. 50%. Prices have declined dramatically. And I was going to give you an example of one town in one state in the Northeast. And that town is New Canaan, Connecticut. And Connecticut, I've talked about them, I've talked about that state, the nutmeg state, a number of times over the past several years. They are broke. They are rudderless. They are leaderless. After 30 years of Democratic rule, that state is a shambles. This was one of the wealthiest states in America 20, 25, 30 years ago. Vibrant, packed, in its own way, I'm a Westerner at heart, in its own way beautiful. It is now a financial, economic, and housing wreck due to Democratic policies. It is the high-end Detroit, or coming Detroit. Wait till I give you these stats. As an example of what's going on in that state, which, by the way, is going on in every Northeast state. Did you know that for the first time in history, there is not a single Republican congressman from the Northeast states in the United States House of Representatives? Not a single Republican, not a single conservative. Some of the Democrats that have recently been elected pretend that they're moderate, but as you will see, and as my example, the gal from Minnesota, today, they are anything but. They simply lied to the voters to get their vote. Because that, folks, is what most of the left does. Remember, the end justifies the means, one of Alinsky's 8 rules. Sow chaos, because out of chaos comes votes. Right? The way Obama phrased that was, never let a crisis go to waste. Same thing. Chaos creates crisis. Crisis creates dependency. Dependency allows you to steal votes. And implement whatever policies you want after being elected, by the way. Imperviously. I want to remind you, by the way, I'm going to remind you several times during the show, that Cindy Hyde-Smith is running against a guy by the name of Emsley in Mississippi. That is November 27th is that election. Folks, that's next week. May I suggest you go to the politics section on the website, www.ontherightsideradio.com. Go to the politics section of the articles listed right below the show and send her some money. The Democrats, first of all, she made a really, really stupid comment about a week and a half ago. And a 9-point race, remember Mississippi's red, a 9-point race is now narrowed to like 3 points. And I can't forgive her for being that stupid. But given the alternative, which is a 52-48 rather than a 53-47 majority in the Senate, which is now key to the America First program, key to offsetting what is going to be a rabid, boy, you wait and see, a rabid Democratic House of Representatives. The only good thing being is that they will be overly rabid and they will get their butts kicked in 2020. The Senate is key. The Senate is key to the judiciary. Look at that judge's ruling out of San Francisco. Segar, Lugar, whatever his name is, doesn't matter. And yes, Trump is right, an Obama judge. Chief Justice Roberts is wrong. There are Obama judges. There are Clinton judges. There are Trump judges. There are Reagan judges. There are Bush judges. And each one of them, although they can kind of be AC-DC on some subjects, each one of them interprets the Constitution differently, which leads to entirely different rulings. As we are painfully aware, the Obama judges in particularity, the Clinton judges to a slightly lesser extent, view the Constitution as an outdated, living, breathing document meant to be interpreted relative to today's needs and wants. Well, last time I checked, today's needs and wants are the same as they were 240 years ago when the Constitution was drafted. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And the maintenance of a constitutional republic, not democracy. So it is their interpretation of the Constitution that leads to their ridiculous rulings, such as this national stay. I mean, right, some judge in San Francisco can stay actions along the entire 2,000-mile Mexican border, 1,500, 2,000 miles away from his office. Something's really wrong with this picture. You know, the district courts were never in the Constitution. They were set up later by Congress, and Congress needs to do something about them. You need to have the district courts, but their authority needs to be limited, either to their circuit. For instance, this guy is in the Ninth Circuit, Ninth Appeals Court Circuit. So his ruling would have effect in the Ninth Circuit and not in the five circuits along the Mexican border. We'll talk more about that in future shows. There's some tweaking that this republic needs, given the barbarians at the gate right now. And at the gate they are. And there's a lot of them, folks. A lot of them. Higher education has produced a horde of barbarians. And that, by the way, is also intentional. We're also going to talk about, and I think you'll find this fascinating, this is in the context, by the way, of the segment that's on New Canaan as an example of a community in the example of a state, in the example of democratic control, and what that has wrought, I mean, to the incredible detriment of Connecticut's population. We're going to be talking about, I had a show. Let me just step to the side here for just a moment. I had a show, a number of shows over the last several years that talked about economics. And I've given you some warnings. And listen, these warnings don't stem from anything Trump is doing or not doing. It doesn't really stem, well, kind of, from what Obama did or didn't do. Quite intentionally, other than the $10 trillion in debt he added. That was intentional. That will have a lasting, detrimental impact on the United States. You know, his fundamental transformation of the United States, as he warned us of in his inaugural speech in 2008. Perry did a pretty good job on some fundamental transformations. You can see it playing out at the border right now, north of Tijuana. But I've given you some warnings. I've raised some red flags for you. And that doesn't mean you don't enjoy the vibrant economy we have now. But look, economy is cyclical. Markets are cyclical. What goes up will, let me underline that, will. Bold, capitalized, italicized, underlined, italics, will come down. And by the way, assuming the system isn't upended, as the left would like to do, they will also go back up. But I have some statistics for you this morning that will shock you. I had some shows in the past. Type in canaries in the economic coal mine. I had some of these warnings for you. I've told you on several shows some incredible statistics. You know, 68% of Americans have less than $500. Liquid assets. We're talking about all liquid assets. Cash under the pillow, cash in their accounts, you know, a couple pieces of silver, whatever they happen to be. Under $500 liquid assets. Well, this is an elaboration on those statistics because where we are in this economy, and this is so apropos because of Black Friday and everybody jumping up and down, oh, there's more people than ever shopping, and the number of shoppers have doubled, and brick-and-mortar sales are 50% ahead of last year. Listen, that's all great. That's terrific. May it continue forever, but it won't. I want to give you some underpinnings here of what's going on with the American population. I was struck by interviews I saw last night of shoppers in New York. And all but, I think there were probably 8 or 9 interviews. It was very well done. It was really one of the best person on the street interview series I've seen. And it was by Raymond Arroyo, who I think is terrific, by the way. Either 8 of 9 or 8 of 10 of the people he questioned, he said, are you going to splurge or hold back? And 8 of them said, oh, I'm going to splurge. The economy's great. I'm going to spend all sorts of money this Christmas. Da-da-da-da-da. One guy said, by the way, he was from Utah. One guy said, no, I'm going to put in savings because compound interest is the most powerful ally I have in building wealth. And one other gal said, well, no, I'm going to spend, but I'm not going to splurge. But 8 of 10 people, all of them, you know, with intelligence, all of them with bags of stuff they had been buying. And I think probably a mix of Democrats, Republicans, liberals, conservatives. 8 of 10 said, the economy's great, I'm splurging. I'm not sure you'll be splurging after I go over this final, it won't be the final segment, but the segment to last on this show this morning. The very last segment is going to tie all the other segments in together. And this has to do with, and I've mentioned it before, Obama's visit to South Africa and the speech that he gave. It was to... Let's see, what was the name of the outfit he was talking to over there? Oh, the 2018 Nelson Mandela Annual Lecture. And by the way, I believe this article was posted. And you can read an entire transcript. There's a link within the article. I'm also going to give you some tidbits. I have a few articles posted this week. But next week, there's been some very interesting developments on the mind control front. That was one of the most popular shows, or two shows, I've ever done. You just type in mind control in the search bar, you can listen to them. But, you know, it appears that MK Ultra, you know, voice-to-skull mind control technology, gee, there was a leak. You know, I mean, our intelligence agencies never leak to try and, you know, influence public opinion, right? There's never a disinformation program going on. But it seems that MK Ultra, the voice-to-skull technology, which we've talked about on previous shows, the CIA has been experimenting with it lately again. Gee, that kind of ties in with our theories as presented on this show, doesn't it? And that they're also opening up research in it again. Now, way more on that next week. That's just a teaser. A couple of articles up this week, just a tease. And I think you'll find that fascinating, too. And let me tell you, it really does support some of the hypotheses I have postulated on this show over the last 6 to 12 months. And it bolsters both of those mind control shows also. But we're going to be talking about, as the last segment, what some of the things that Barry Baby said when he was over there in South Africa. You know, South Africa, where it's a democracy, not a republic, where the current strongman has gotten his legislature, we'll call it, his assembly, the General Assembly, to unilaterally change the Constitution, and who is now appropriating without due process and without compensation whatsoever the farms and lands and properties of anyone in South Africa who is not black. That includes brown people. That includes Spanish people. That includes white people. If you ain't black, you don't get to own it. And I want to go over with you in much more detail, particularly given the outcome of this last election. This is how it all ties in. Particularly given the mindset of the left right now, and particularly given the warnings, subtle as they may be, but kind of in your face at the same time, of some of our elected leaders, and certainly some of the leaders on the left, what their views are of what's going on in South Africa. Because, folks, it's a big red flag. A big red flag. I'll tie it all in for you here in that last segment. Let's start off with our story. So once upon a time, in a land not so far away, they wanted to proclaim a holiday. A holiday with feasting and fun and love and family and reverence for country. And at the time they proclaimed that holiday, there was a speech given by one of the great leaders in this land not so far away. I'm going to read you that speech very quickly. It's kind of in old English, so bear with the words. And then I'm going to tell you whose speech it was. And then I'm going to tell you what the left now says about this holiday. Whereas it is the duty of all nations to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God, to obey His will, to be grateful for His benefits, and humbly to implore His protection and favor. And whereas both houses of Congress have by their joint committee requested me to recommend to the people of the United States a day of public thanksgiving and prayer to be observed by acknowledging with grateful hearts the many signal favors of Almighty God, especially by affording them an opportunity peaceably to establish a form of government for their safety and happiness. Now, therefore, I do recommend and assign Thursday, the 26th of November, next, to be devoted by the people of these states to the service of that great and glorious being, who is the beneficent author of all the good that was, that is, or that will be, that we may then unite in rendering unto him our sincere and humble thanks for his kind care and protection of the people of this country previous to their becoming a nation, for the signal and manifold mercies and the favorable interpositions of his providence, which we experience in the course and conclusion of the late war, for the great degree of tranquility, union, and plenty, which we have since enjoyed, for the peaceable and rational manner in which we have been enabled to establish constitutions of government for our safety and happiness, and particularly the national one now lately instituted, for the civil and religious liberty with which we are blessed, and the means we have of acquiring and diffusing useful knowledge, and in general for all the great and various factors which he hath been pleased to confer upon us, and also that we may then unite in most humbly offering our prayers and supplications to the great Lord and ruler of nations, and beseech him to pardon our national and other transgressions, to enable us all, whether in public or private stations, to perform our several and relative duties properly and punctually, to render our national government a blessing to all the people, by constantly being a government of wise, just, and constitutional laws, discreetly and faithfully executed and obeyed, to protect and guide all sovereigns and nations, especially such as have shown kindness unto us, and to bless them with good government, peace, and concord, to promote the knowledge and practice of true religion and virtue, and the increase of science among them and us, and generally to grant unto all mankind such a degree of temporal prosperity as he alone knows to be best. That, folks, was the proclamation of the first president of the United States, George Washington, shortly after being elected as the first president, shortly after ratification of the Constitution, and the beginnings of the Thanksgiving holiday, which now the left says is racist, outdated, should be abolished, or transformed. Don't believe me? Google it up. Just in the last week, the crazies have come out of the closet. So that's our story for today. Historical and rather fascinating. Think about those words. Replay it, in fact. If you folks are listening on podcast, or you folks on radio, go to podcast. Listen to it again. Prescient, is it? Apropos to today, is it? And many lessons in it. For all of us, I might add. I got several emails. Last week's show, I talked about I explained to you the various different votes and the shenanigans of the so-called Democrats in trying to steal elections, which, by the way, they successfully did. Since the last show, folks, 12 congressional seats, 12, have been stolen by the left in the same exact way. The use of provisional ballots, the use of cure ballots, holding elections open and not calling them, and by unscrupulous and treasonous commissioners of election in left leaning districts and counties. Same thing you saw in Florida, which, by the way, we would have lost both races there. Now, trust me on this, if Scott had not gotten in their face, like, immediately and drawn public scrutiny, which they simply could not avoid, to that Senate and gubernatorial race, I have great respect for him. I always kind of liked him. Now I really like him. This guy's a fighter. And in his saving of those two seats by directing national scrutiny on the fraud that was rampant in this Florida election. I'm going to tell you a little bit about that in just a moment. You have no idea. I mean, we're not talking about just 25 canvassing board thrown out votes being mixed in with a batch of 200 by Snipes down there in Broward County. You know, 25 illegal votes right there. We're not talking about just the attorneys for Gillum, the Democratic gubernatorial candidate, and Nelson, the Democratic incumbent trying to keep his Senate seat. We're not talking about them standing in front of a federal judge and arguing that ballots by illegal aliens, I'm not making this up, Google it, ballots by illegal aliens should be counted because every vote should be counted. No, we're talking about a much more insidious, rampant, and widespread voter fraud in Florida, and particularly Broward and Palm Beach counties. And when I explain that to you, you will understand why McSally lost to a leftist, lying, liberal, crazy lady, Sinema, in Arizona. And you will understand why, over the last week, all seven Republican congressional seats in Orange County, California, which has always been Republican and is Republican, why, despite Orange County voting for the Republican, the losing Republican gubernatorial candidate by over 250,000 votes more than the Democratic Gavin, the Democratic candidate for California governor, that these Congress folks mysteriously lost in elections that were held open with the uses of mysteriously appearing provisional ballots, cure ballots, absentee ballots that were not pronounced as part of the total vote count within 30 minutes of the polls closing as required by law, who were leading by 5 to 8%. We're not talking about a couple thousand votes. 5 to 8% margins on election night, and now have lost those elections. Orange County has gone from being Republican complete throughout forever to now suddenly, mysteriously, in this election, being completely Democratic. In a county that cast 250,000 more votes for the Republican governor candidate than somehow there were in the congressional races. Now, I don't know about you, but given what happened in Florida, given what happened with the example I gave you down in the southeastern district of New Mexico last week, given what happened in Arizona, yes, even given what happened in Montana, where Rosendahl just kind of buckled and didn't fight whatsoever, although I think he could have won that seat from Tester. This will tell you what we're up against. This will tell you what we're up against. Let me give you those numbers. If you crunch the numbers in the Florida election, folks, the total number of registered voters, you know, grab a pencil or a pen and a piece of paper and follow along with me on this. Or put this on replay after you've listened to the show. Because I'm not making this up. This is just math. Just math. And it's not something you're going to hear in any mainstream media. They've already moved on. In fact, the left has made sure they've moved on. There's all sorts of stuff out there that are distractions. You know why? Because the left not only wants to talk about those items, not only wants to distract about what's happening with Hillary here in this federal court, not only wants to distract as the noose tightens around all the crooks and treasonous players in the FBI, the CIA, and the Obama administration, but they want to get our minds immediately off Florida. Don't think that after the fight in Florida and the public scrutiny that the sudden concessions, just a few days after the show last week, by Nelson and Gillum were because they're good guys and they saw the writing on the wall. No. They were told by the higher-ups, you know what? It's time to quit this. It's getting too much scrutiny. We made our test runs for 2020. We've seen them successful in the Northeast. We've seen them successful in Orange County. We saw them almost successful in Florida. We've seen them successful in Montana and Arizona. And don't rock the boat. You know, we don't want sunlight. And the longer it takes for you to give up, the more sunlight's going to be down there and the more the other side's going to figure out what we're doing. That's why they conceded. So follow along with me on these numbers. Get a pen and a piece of paper, because when we're done with this, you are going to be disgusted. Disgusted. The total number of registered voters in Miami-Dade County is 1,433,668. The total number of people who voted for Rick Scott, the Republican senatorial candidate, and Bill Nelson, is 801,209 votes. That leaves 632,459 folks who apparently didn't vote. Let's go to the next set of math. There were 150,000 votes brought in after, illegally, contrary to the Florida state constitution and contrary to federal law and contrary to state law. 150,000 votes were mysteriously found in those two counties after the polls closed. Neither of those two counties, despite being required by law and the Constitution to do so, set forth the total number of votes they had received of all types within 30 minutes of the polls closing. A requirement. A requirement, by the way, exactly to not allow what I'm going over with you right now. So, 150,000, and by the way, folks, they knew how many votes were in. They knew how many people hadn't voted. They knew what kind of margin they had to fraudulently play with. It's kind of the point I'm getting to here. I mean, if we know how many registered voters there are, and we know how many votes were cast for Scott and for Nelson, as of the polls, 30 minutes after the polls closed, they sure as hell knew it. And they knew they had 632,000 votes to play with to try and swing these elections fraudulently and treasonously. In Palm Beach County, write these down, there were 928,696 registered voters. Rick Scott received 244,776 votes. Bill Nelson, 343,780 votes, for a total of 588,556 votes. Subtract that from the 928,696 total registered voters. There were 340,140 people who didn't vote. Broward County has 1,167,982 registered voters. Rick Scott received, this is as of the polls closing, folks, 211,119 votes. Bill Nelson, 471,334 votes. A total of 982,453 total votes between them. That means that the total number of registered voters who did not vote as of the polls closing was 185,529. And by the way, those numbers which skew toward Nelson are correct. I don't doubt the sanctity of the overwhelming majority of votes, although there was probably thousands of fraudulent votes, but the overwhelming number of votes in the general context as of the closing of the polls. It is what number of those original votes were improper or illegal and not thrown out, and the new votes that were manufactured after the polls closed in the void that was created by those counties not reporting how many total votes, which I'm reporting to you right now, they had received as of the polls closing, within 30 minutes of the polls closing, as required by law and the Constitution. Let's keep going on this math. So between those three counties, Miami-Dade, Palm Beach, and Broward, there is a sum of 1,158,128 voters who did not vote at all for Scott or Nelson as of the closing of the polls. There are 2,318,218 voters who did. The grand total of all those people who did and did not vote in those three counties is 3,476,346 voters. Now, let's get off the Senate races. Let's get off the Senate race. This will make your eyes roll in your head. If you count the votes for the other candidates, not the Senate candidates, there were 17,794 votes. This is write-in candidates for Senate, and when I say not for the Senate candidates, not for those two Senate candidates. There was another 17,794 votes that went, you know, the Sally Lou, Betty May, you know, the man in the moon, that were cast in the senatorial election, not for Nelson or Scott. The highest voter turnout ever in those counties have been in presidential election years, like everywhere, and was 80%. Those counties have never had a voter turnout greater than 80% of all registered voters. The average voter turnout in a midterm election is 40%. Obviously, this midterm was hyped to all get out. Let's say that there was a voter turnout, which these numbers that I just gave you seems to bear out, of about 60%. And by the way, you can play with that percentage all you want. You're going to come up with the same conclusion, just slightly different end totals, as you'll see. But let's use 60%, a really, really high, 50% higher than normal turnout for a midterm election. And I believe a record for all three counties. And let's use that in our math that we're doing now. With the 17,000 votes that were cast, I'm rounding numbers here, for other candidates, and the 150,000 votes magically found after the polls closed, in other words, over and above the totals I've given you, that means that in the Nelson, Scott, etc. senatorial race in those three counties, there was a grand sum of 2,486,012 votes altogether. This is everything. The 150,000 fraudulent votes after the election, the 17,000 and change votes for other candidates, and all the votes that were tabulated, even though not reported, as of the closing of the polls on election day. At 60%, folks, 60% of the 2,486,000 folks that comprise the total registered voters in those counties. There was 1,390,000. Let me go back, because this is really important. I want you to follow it. Taking into consideration the absolute highest voter turnout ever in these counties was 80%, using a wildly optimistic 60% turnout in this election would mean that 1,390,500 people actually voted. The problem here is that we have 2,486,012 votes claimed by these counties, including the 17,000 and the 150,000 fraudulent votes found after the election closed. That is 1,000,000, this is shocking, 1,095,473 votes, folks, that don't exist. I don't know if you're following me on this. The fraud in those three counties, and particularly Broward and Palm Beach, Miami-Dade actually followed the rules, reported their votes, was on time with their recounts, was on time with the total number. So, you know, the fraud that occurred there occurred, but it was not precipitous, intentional, wildly malignant, like in Palm Beach and Broward counties. And no matter how you slice and dice this pie, there were 1,095,473 votes, of which, including the 150,000 that came in magically after the election, that were manufactured in this election. In those three counties, the huge preponderance being in Palm Beach and Broward. 1,000,000 votes, folks, were manufactured by the left that did not exist. Gee, You don't want to go with my 60% number, voter turnout? Go with 70%. Guess what? That means there was 800,000 votes manufactured. You want to go with 80%, the highest turnout ever in a presidential year? That means there were 600,000 votes manufactured. This is rampant fraud, folks. This is not a couple votes here and there. This is an attempt to blatantly, maliciously, treasonously, feloniously steal elections. The governor's office in a 29 electoral vote state and a senatorial seat in the key body politic that's responsible for appointing judges and all sorts of other extremely important functions of the federal government, functions that affect your life, liberty, and property. You know the little speech that George Washington gave? And your prosperity and your safety and your health. Listen to this segment again if you want, or hopefully you wrote down the numbers. You do the math. There is no way on God's green earth that many votes, that many legitimate votes were actually cast. No way. And you can use any percentage of voter turnout you want. And of course, those numbers are still not out of Broward and Palm Beach counties because they still haven't reported them. Because if they report them, folks, I'm not the only one and some others that can do this math. We all have calculators. We have plenty of facts. We know that they reported themselves to be true, to interpolate what actually happened down there. And it ain't 25 votes, and it ain't a couple thousand votes. It is somewhere between, choose whatever turnout number you want, a whopping, incredible, unbelievable 80%, or a 50%, actually 100% increase, 60% turnout in this election, or any number in between. And you have hundreds and hundreds of thousands, in fact, at 60%, over a million fabricated votes from those counties alone. Gee, you wonder why McSally was up by 30,000 votes in Arizona and then, you know, a lack of reporting and the election wasn't called and Sinema winds up winning a week later with 30,000 votes and 300,000 votes magically found after the polls closed. You wonder why those 7 seats were lost in Orange County with candidates leading by 5 to 8%. I mean, that's a big lead on election night when the polls close. You wonder why Rosendahl lost by 3,000 votes in Montana, but unfortunately didn't have the guts to scream and yell and jump up and down like Scott did. And I can go on and on. There's examples across the United States. If you take all the examples and the results that have been the election night results that have been overturned by this widespread, rampant, and I don't mean just a few votes, I mean millions of votes, fraud practice run by the Democratic Party in this last election, you come up with a Republican majority or a Democratic majority in the House of like 2 seats if you take out voter fraud, the voter fraud we know of. You come up with a 55-45 split in the Senate rather than a 53-47. That's assuming that Cindy Hyde-Smith wins next Tuesday. And let me exhort you again. Go to the politics site or dial up her website and send her some money. $10, $30, $50, whatever. I did. Not because I'm a particularly big fan of Cindy Hyde-Smith. Not because I have any respect for the stupid, just stupid thing she said. And by the way, I don't believe that it was ill-intentioned. But, you know, anybody who would say something like that, and for those of you who didn't hear it, she was talking to some constituents and an old friend of hers, and she's a rancher, okay? She's not a city person. And, you know, ranchers have their way of talking to one another. Trust me, I know. Kind of cut to the chase and sometimes make ribald jokes. Sometimes off-color ribald jokes. And in this particular case, she was talking to this guy. She was being recorded, which everybody, you know, any candidate should know by now. And she said, "I like you so much, I'd go to a public hanging with you." Well, that happens to be a phrase. But, of course, the left jumped on it and said, oh, you know, racist, and Mississippi's had 57 hangings. Well, you can imagine what they did with it. So, you know, Trump's had to address it in his rallies down there. She's had to address it. She's been on the defensive. She's lost 6 points in the polls. Just stupidity. That doesn't change the fact that we need her in the United States Senate, and we don't need another Democrat, particularly, by the way, this Emsley guy is like, you know, he's only one or two levels below Sinema, who is scary in Arizona. He's a lefty's lefty. He is no moderate Democrat. You know, the Democrat Doug Jones, who got, once again, because of stupid stuff by the Republican candidate, who got elected in Alabama, if you remember, last year. He was supposed to be moderate. He's going to work with Republicans. Nonsense. He hasn't worked with Republicans at all. He hasn't voted with Republicans. He's voted totally for Schumer's nonsense because, like the gal who got elected from Minnesota that we're going to talk about next, they lie. Okay? These folks lie. They will lie for your vote. They will steal your vote. They will cancel out your vote with fraud. They don't care how they obtain power, so long as they obtain power. And we need some serious, serious revamping of voter laws around the United States. Serious. I'm going to give you a few ideas this morning, but I'm going to move right along here because we got a lot to cover. All right. Let's talk about, because it ties right in. Let's talk about, this gal's name, and if I mispronounce it, my apologies, but actually, they're not heartfelt. Her last name is Omar. Why don't we just say Omar, okay? Omar is a Somali-American. She's the first female Muslim member of Congress. She took Keith Ellison's seat in Minnesota. This is in a district that has not a high preponderance, but a swing vote of Jewish voters. It's unbelievable. Unbelievable. Which is going to tie into my next segment. let me read you her exact quote during her... By the way, this is just one example. Okay, number one, she's having the House of Representatives change their rules to allow headgear to be worn in the chamber. Now, since the founding of the House of Representatives, you are not allowed to wear a hat in Congress. But the House is going to change the rules just for her so she can wear her habib. Unbelievable. That's just the tip of the iceberg. Let me give you some more important facts. I'm just going to dwell on one. This is her exact statement during her campaign. I believe right now with the BDS movement, I'll explain that in a moment. Remember BDS. Remember that acronym. I believe right now with the BDS movement, it's not helpful in getting that two-state solution. I think the particular purpose is to make sure there is pressure. And I think that pressure really is counteractive. Because in order for us to have a process of getting to a two-state solution, she's talking about Palestine and Israel, people have to be willing to come to the table and have a conversation about how that is going to be possible. And I think that, BDS, stops the dialogue. Well, guess what? Within days of her election, after fighting during her campaign that claims that she had anti-Israel and anti-Jewish views, you know, saying no, despite her telling groups of Jewish voters in Minnesota that she opposed the economic boycott of Israel, calling it counteractive and not helpful in getting to a two-state solution, she did an interview Sunday. This is last Sunday, folks. This is 4 days after the election. Omar, in the interview, by the way, the interview was in Muslim Girl, the magazine Muslim Girl. Omar said, I quote, "I support the BDS movement," unquote. This is 4 days after the election. I quote from the Washington Free Beacon. Ilhan, by the way, that's, you know, it's Ilhan Omar. Ilhan believes in and supports the BDS movement and has fought to make sure people's right to support it isn't criminalized. Her campaign told Muslim Girl, which said Omar had been criticized for coming out against BDS. This is a Muslim girl. Omar's campaign also pointed Muslim girl to her vote against an anti-BDS bill in Minnesota's state legislature, and her argument that boycott movements were successful in South Africa. Oh, well, this is going to tie into the last segment, isn't it? I'm telling you, the left has a grand plan. This is a complete reversal, folks, of what she said on the campaign trail. And the moronic, and I say that as their brethren, the moronic left-leaning Jews of Minnesota in this district elected this woman. They didn't believe how she had voted in the past. They didn't believe her public discourse in the past. They didn't believe the Habib on her head. They obviously have not read the Quran. They obviously don't know anything about Sharia. And they voted for her based on her representation to them that she was pro-Israel and anti-Israeli boycotts and Palestinian violence, which is what BDS is all about. What she really believes, folks, and it was out there for these folks to see before they pulled the lever. The only path to peace doesn't lie in a two-state solution. It lies in a hybrid Palestinian-Israeli state, which encompasses the entire territory. In which case, the Jews, of course, within the state would be 7 million, and the Palestinians would be 56 million. Gee, how do you think that democracy is going to work for the Jews? Not very well. Because I guarantee you it's not going to be a constitutional republic, is it? This is also what Barack Obama supported, despite his lies to the contrary. He never supported a two-state solution. He didn't lift his finger other than rhetoric to ever implement it. The left is the left, folks. There is an unholy alliance between the left and radical Islam. I've done shows on it. Type it in the search bar. Unholy alliance. It is irrefutable, irrevocable, and absolute. You cannot argue with the conclusions or the facts or the lines between the dots. And this gal, the election of this gal tells us much. Tells us much. Now, the Democratic Party, alarmed over losing the left-wing Jewish vote, which it relies on, and which left-wing Jews moronically give to them every single election, despite being slapped in the face, despite Democratic support for anti-Semitic personalities such as Farrakhan, you know, Barry posing for pictures with him, Keith Ellison being his best buddy. It is absolutely incredible to me. It is the difference between progressives who are mindless and ideological and liberals who are Americans who lean left. It is unbelievable. And this gal is the tip of the iceberg. Now, the Democratic Party, quote-unquote Democratic, unquote, party, has said that, gee, that's not their views, and they're going to take anybody who thinks like that, and if they're anti-Israel, they're going to be frozen out of committees and legislation. Yeah, right. You wait and see if that friggin' lie happens. Which gets me to the next topic. Left-wing Jews. You know, the Jewish culture, the Jewish people, the Jewish religion has contributed incredibly to civilization. As all the Christians who listen to me know, Jesus was first a Jew and then a Christian. Judeo-Christian principles are what founded America. It is those principles that George Washington talked about in his speech proclaiming Thanksgiving that I read to you as my story at the beginning of this show. And for the most part, Christians and Jews have coexisted peacefully, or at least without hostility. And that doesn't mean there hasn't been persecution. That doesn't mean that, there was no religion in Hitler's Nazi Germany. I'm not saying that there weren't many Germans who were Christians, who out of fear, out of not really knowing what was going on, out of believing the lies of the government, did nothing to help the Jews as Hitler was trying to implement his final solution for the Jewish race. But the Nazi Party has no religion, folks. It had no religion. The Communist Party has no religion. They are not Christians. They are atheists. Government is their God. Government is their God. And Judaism, in my opinion, because of its strong roots, because it dates back 5,000 years, because of the important role Jews have played in science and arts and finances and business and all sorts of things throughout civilization, they have been targets. But they have brought much of this on themselves, because the people who have targeted them, a faction of the Jewish folks, have put these people in power and allowed them to remain in power. In other words, left-wing Jews throughout history have contributed to the assuming of power by the very people who turned on them, oppressed them, and killed them, and who now want to continue that oppression, continue, I'm sure, in the minds of many of these alt-left and alt-left Islamists would love to continue the killing process, and certainly want to exterminate, do away with, abolish, dilute, get rid of Israel. They're doing the same thing. You would think that left-wing Jews over 5,000 years would have learned a lesson or two. But unfortunately, they have not. The Jewish vote went preponderously for Barack Obama in both the 08 and 12 elections. Barack Obama, an ally of Muslims, a staunch supporter of Iran, his right-hand lieutenant for decades, Valerie Jarrett, born in Tehran, Iran. Iran, as you know, an archenemy of Israel. Barack Obama, who is for the Palestinian state rather than the two-state solution, who did virtually nothing but lip service and gloss to any peaceful resolution, who supplied, this is all in my shows, you can Google it up. Never mind my shows, Google it up. Enlighten yourselves. And I'm talking to you folks who are Jewish who are listening to me and who lean left. Educate yourselves. You think you're so highly educated? You're not. Get with the program. Get with the facts. Or eventually you will get with the program. And you know of what I speak. Barack Obama, who so hated Israel and America, but that's besides the point, that he spent $300,000 of our taxpayer money trying to interfere in the Israeli election and the re-election of Netanyahu. You voted for him twice. You know, I am much more spiritual now than I am Jewish. I'm proud of my Jewish heritage, my background. I'm proud of being raised in the Jewish tradition up to the time I was bar mitzvahed at the age of 13. But I am not a fan of any organized religion for a whole bunch of reasons I'm not going to go into in this show. My belief in a higher power is absolute, but it is spiritual. I don't care whether you call it energy, spirit, Buddha, God, Jesus. To me, it's all the same. It is the higher power. You left-leaning Jewish folks out there, and you know, my family, there's some on the East Coast, there's some on the West Coast, and there's a number of us out here in the West, in the Rocky Mountains. And you know, all of the family that's in the Rockies, from Montana to Arizona, are conservative. And all of the family, with very few exceptions, that are on the coasts, are left-leaning Jews. And you cannot talk to them. They will not listen. I send them articles. In fact, the article that I'm reviewing right now, I'll give you the author's name in just a moment, I sent to them. Not a peep. Not a peep. I sent them the article on Omar, her, should we say, 72-hour about-face from her positions in the campaign when talking to Jewish voters in Minnesota, to her positions in her interview by Muslim Girl on the Sunday following the election. Not a peep. This is the same attitude, folks, that allowed Hitler to come to power in Germany, and, as some more examples, Karl Marx, right? The original communist, author of the Communist Manifesto. Karl Marx was the grandson of two Orthodox rabbis, folks. His parents had converted to Christianity. In the 1800s, prior to and after him writing his manifesto, he wrote a piece called On the Jewish Question. It was published in 1844. Feel free to Google it up. Let me give you a few quotes from that. What is the worldly religion of the Jew? Huckstering. What is his worldly god? Money. Money is the jealous god of Israel, in the face of which no other god may exist. And you'll love this one. In the final analysis, the emancipation of the Jews is the emancipation of mankind from Judaism. Wow. I wonder where Lenin and Stalin and Hitler, and to a lesser extent Mao, I wonder where they got their ideas for the final solution. Oh, that's right. From an alt-left leaning Jew. That is, of course, what Marx is referring to as the emancipation of mankind from the Jews. In the early 20th century, another left-wing Jew, his name was Leon Trotsky. He was kind of Lenin's partner in crime, and he led the Bolshevik army in Russia. When Trotsky was the head of the Red Army, folks, Moscow's chief rabbi, whose name, by the way, was Jacob Mazeh, M-A-Z-E-H, asked him to use the Bolshevik army to protect the Jews from the pogromist attacks in which tens of thousands of Jews were being murdered in revolutionary Russia. Trotsky's response, I quote, "Why do you come to me? I am not a Jew." The rabbi responded, quote, "That's the tragedy. It is the Trotskys who make revolutions, and it is the Bronsteins who pay the price," unquote. The same is happening now on a slightly smaller but ascending scale. Left-wing Jews played a role in the election of Barack Obama twice. Left-wing Jews have played roles in the communist dictatorship in Venezuela and Cuba. left-wing Jews basically elected the first Muslim female and Keith Ellison before her to the Congress in Minnesota. Left-wing Jews have played a major role in the elimination of all Republican, i.e. conservative, congresspeople from the Northeast. I don't know to what extent left-wing Jews played a role, if any, in Orange County, California. I think that was like total voter fraud. And I don't know to what extent, if any, left-wing Jews played a role in the election of Sinema, also really a product of voter fraud, in Arizona. But I do know that left-wing Jews have a 5,000-year habit of electing their own oppressors. And it really has to stop. I mean, left-wing Jews, it's okay to be left. It's okay to be empathetic. It's okay to hate Trump. But it's not okay to be ignorant. It's not okay to blindly believe. It's not okay to look at somebody's record yet be swayed by their words as they're trying to extract your vote from you. It's not okay to elect people who are anti-Israel and anti-Semites to boot. This author of this article went to a, and by the way, this stems a lot from academia, which happens to be a problem. I don't care what sect, what religion, or what ideology, unless you're the ideology of the left, that's a problem, as we're going to talk about. Did you know, a slight digression here, that fortunately 37% of millennials did not vote in the last election, in the midterms? Or the results, compounded with Democratic voter fraud, might have been far worse. The millennials now outnumber the baby boomers, folks. The millennials have been brought up through the same education system as left-wing Jews. And by the way, unfortunately, I say this with huge regret, an education system which is laced through and through with left-wing Jewish educators. The millennials who did vote voted 64% left, Democratic, left ideals, and 36% conservative ideals. Extrapolate that out, folks. That is scary. Scary for the future of this country. And to a large extent, and I regret to say it, it pains me to say it, left-wing Jewish academic establishment shares a large part, not all, but a large part of the blame. A hugely detrimental to the Constitution and the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness of all of us. And by the way, there are many other perpetrators. I happen to be singling out my own kind right now. I play no favorites. It is arguably true that the security of Israel might be the single greatest plum, shall we say, that should be protected by the world's Jewish folks. But unfortunately, time after time after time after time, left-leaning Jews vote for folks who say they are for Israel, but whose actions and prior record says just the opposite. Keith Ellison, Omar, Obama. I mean, the list is endless. The list is endless. Look at the votes in New York. New York voted 80% for left side Democratic, and in some cases totally socialistic, candidates. 80%. The largest concentration of Jews in the United States is in New York. I don't have any statistics on what the Jewish vote was, either Republican or Democrat, in the state of New York for this last election, but I will bet you it was 80% for left-leaning politicians, including Ortez, the 28-year-old from the, you know, I've talked about her. She's unbelievable. A proclaimed socialist, and by the way, believes just as Omar does, the proper solution for Israel is no Israel. It's a single Palestinian-Jewish combined state. And she was elected handily. I don't know the percentage of Jews in her district, but there has to be some. You know, many non-Orthodox, for those of you who are not familiar with the Jewish faith, except peripherally, there are basically three types of Judaism. Orthodox, Reform, and Moderate. Moderate is called different names. Orthodox is, you know, the strict kind of practice of the faith. They are many times the folks that you see with the hats, some cases the beards. I mean, they are, you know, they don't ride in a car on Saturday. The Sabbath is sacrosanct. I can go on and on. Those are that's Orthodox Judaism. The conservative or moderate, I don't use the word politically, the conservative Jewish congregations, moderate Jewish congregations, are somewhere in between. The Reform congregations are the, I hate to use this term, but it's the best picture I can paint for you. It's the yuppies of Judaism. How's that? Yeah, you know, they're kind of Jewish, and they kind of go to synagogue once in a while, and they kind of do this and that and the other, but, you know, they are much more secular, really, than Jewish. And non-Orthodox synagogues, many, many non-Orthodox, that would be moderate and Reform, sat Shiva. And for those of you who don't know what Shiva is, it is the 7 days of mourning when a loved one passes. And I'm making all this stuff very general for you so you can follow it. They sat 7 days of mourning, Shiva, when Donald Trump was elected president. But virtually none of them, in fact, I can't find a record of one, I'm sure there's has to be one, none of them sat Shiva when 11 Jews were killed in a synagogue in Pittsburgh. Think about that. And then many of those congregations, the rabbis, blamed Donald Trump for the murders in the synagogue by an anti-Trump nut. Look, everybody gets to, oh, you're right, producer. Let me give you an example of education. So the author of this article, let me give you his name. Actually, I don't have his name. I'll give him credit in the posting. He debated at the Oxford Union just a few years ago. And the question of the debate was whether or not Israel or Hamas were greater obstacles to peace in the Middle East. The debate had three people in it. One of his adversaries in the debate was a Jewish former professor, gee, here we go, at Oxford. And he argued that Israel was a greater threat to peace than Hamas. Another prominent left-wing Jew was his other adversary, MIT professor Noam Chomsky. Do you notice the higher education here? And he has devoted his life, you look him up, C-H-O-M-S-K-Y. Noam, N-O-A-M, Chomsky, MIT professor. Think about all the young lives he has touched. He has devoted his life to writing and speaking against two countries, the United States and Israel. Look him up. He is the perfect example of the influential left-leaning Jew. I mean, he's like the poster boy. So what I'm going to say to the Jewish folks who listen to me, or those of you who listen to me who have Jewish friends, assuming they lean left, wake up. You are installing your own demise. Karl Marx once said, "We will sell capitalists the rope with which we hang them." Think about those words. Think about Karl Marx. Think about Karl Marx's, should we say, viewpoints on Jews and Judaism. And then equate that with Karl Marx and all the left-wing despots. Despots who share in many ways, and in some ways always, the ideologies for which you vote. And think about how that is good for you, personally. Your faith. Fellow Jews. Fellow Americans. Fellow Israelis. Fellow lovers of freedom of religion and speech and action. And hopefully, one day, perhaps in 2020, you will get to atone for your bad choices in the past. Let's go to the next segment, because we have zillions of things to cover here. Hillary, baby. Crooked Hillary. Boy, is she. So the DOJ, as you probably know, is continuing to probe the Clinton Foundation, the Uranium One deal, which is Bob Mueller. All these ants are clinging to the Mueller investigation and associated nonsense. The Democrats are planning all their investigations in the House. In one way, yes, maybe they can find something and get rid of Trump and et cetera, et cetera. But let me tell you, in my opinion, you ever hear the phrase, the best defense is offense? These folks know they're screwed. They know Hillary, Obama, Rice, Comey, McCabe, Strzok, Lisa Page, Susan Powers, Samantha Powers, excuse me, Susan Rice, Ben Rhodes, Valerie Jarrett. I mean, there's a list of 50. They know these people have committed high crimes and treason against the United States. They know it. They know that multitudes of felonies have been broken. They know the security of the country has been put at risk. Hillary's emails, Hillary's server, Benghazi, you name it. Money to Iran, cash to Iran. Attempted undermining of Israeli elections. Taking out Gaddafi. Destabilizing the Middle East. Allowing ISIS to grow and not taking it out. The list is endless. They know that the goods are out there. They know what they've done. But their ideology comes heads and tails above their fellow Americans, particularly the Constitution, which they view as their enemy anyway, and the values of America and Israel. And by continuing to stir the pot on this nonsense Russia collusion, nonsense emoluments clause, nonsense obstruction of justice, I mean, all this crap that they've been screwing around with for 3 years, and to divert us and to blunt the thrust of the misuse of FISA courts, the Russian collusion on the fake dossier, the use of a foreign national agent, totally against the law, to compile the dossier, the leaks by the intelligence agency, the treasonous actions of Brennan and Clapper, the absolute lies, proven, Google it, under oath by Brennan and Clapper to Congress. And Bob Mueller's insidious little fingers in a lot of it, including Uranium One and the kickbacks of the Clinton Foundation, to blunt our probe and bringing to justice those entirely un-American and corrupt acts. They're continuing with their nonsense. Unfortunately for Hillary, she's now run into a judge that says you will produce the information that's requested. And it involves a lawsuit around Benghazi. I told you, folks, back in 2012, I told you Benghazi was not going away, that it would always be with us. And here it is. And it surfaced from time to time with detrimental effects to Hillary and the left and Barack Obama over since the incredibly sad thing event occurred. And here we are, back to Benghazi. And by the way, I'm glad of it. The reason Chris Stevens was killed, I'm not sure we're going to know the reason for a while, but I have to think it was to cover, I think his death was allowed. I think his death was hoped for. I think his death could have been facilitated by the Obama administration, Hillary Clinton, to cover the tracks on the arms sales to radical Islamists, including, by the way, the precursors of ISIS. Stevens was really heavily involved in arms sales to groups which were thought to be, should we say, pro-American ideals and anti-radical Islam ideals. However, in reality, these groups are radical Islamists themselves. And Barack Obama supplying arms to them had to be covered up. There's only one way that the well-armed, trained, and planned attack could have occurred at the exact precise moment during the 24-hour period that Chris Stevens was at the consulate in Benghazi, and he only planned to be there for 24 hours, one night. And on that night, the attack occurred. And there was, the folks that wanted to go over and rescue Stevens were told to stand down by the station chief, who got the orders from Washington. We've yet to find out who gave those orders. Despite frantic calls for help for 13 hours, no help arrived. When they got the survivors from the consulate back to the consulate. Of course, at that time, we didn't know Stevens was dead, remember? Think about the timeline. You didn't know Stevens had died until sometime after the 13-hour period of the attack on the CIA station following the successful attack on the consulate and the rescue of the surviving consulate people by the CIA security team that said, the hell with your orders, we're going to save our fellow Americans. Think about the timeline. Now, let me bring attention to you some emails which have surfaced in this court case now that Hillary and the State Department, etc., have to produce them. March 27th, 2011. Clinton's chief of staff, Jacob Sullivan, writes to Clinton. This is over the unsecure server being hacked by at least five different state actors. And he writes to her about the NATO mission in Libya. Sullivan writes that someone named Bill was, quote, trying to make sure Chris Stevens gets into East Libya, unquote, i.e. Benghazi. I mean, everybody knows where the consulates are. I quote, the current game plan is for Mr. Stevens to move no later than Wednesday from Malta to Benghazi. He will stage offshore initially for a one-day visit, during which he will have meetings with TNC interlocutors and get a sense of the situation on the ground. The goal of this one-day trip is for him to lay the groundwork for a stay of up to 30 days. April 8th, 2011. This is an email among State Department employees that was later forwarded to Clinton on her unsecure server. Quote, security situation in Benghazi remains quiet. Chris Stevens and team are in the hotel, moving only for meetings as required, end quote. April 10th, 2011. This is another email among State Department employees later forwarded to Clinton. Quote, the situation in Ajibaya has worsened to the point where Stevens is considering departure from Benghazi. The envoy's delegation is currently doing a phased checkout. April 24th, 2011. Also, an email among State Department employees also forwarded to Clinton on her unsecured server. Quote, Stevens will be meeting with MFA in 1 hour and will make a written request for better security at the hotel and for better security-related coordination at the consulate. He still feels comfortable in the hotel. They're looking into the idea of moving into a via, but that is some way off, unquote. If you look at that email closely, folks, at the bottom, Hillary writes, by the way, she uses the initial H, Chris Smith. Chris Smith happens to be one of the Americans that were later killed. But the wrong name remained in the email chain. Nobody corrected it. In other words, nobody was focused on the situation over there, folks. They wanted an outcome. Clinton and the State Department and Clinton's unsecured server revealed Chris Stevens' location. Couldn't even get his name right. That's how closely they were paying attention. On five different occasions leading up to the attack. Five different occasions. You know, if you look at Clinton and Obama and the State Department, if you look at the whole Benghazi mess, you could chalk up a single instance of whatever to incompetence. You could chalk up a single instance of whatever to neglect. But in point of fact, Hillary, the State Department, and Obama failed the Americans, our fellow Americans, three different distinct times. She failed them when she declined to adequately supply and arm them, when they requested it for months. She failed them because she never answered or responded to their repeated request for help the night of the attack for 13 hours. She failed them when she lied to their families about what precipitated the attack, you know, the video nonsense later fully exposed. She failed them. And in doing so, she failed America. And in doing so, she failed you and I. And in doing so, she failed the man who wrote the proclamation that created the first Thanksgiving. And hopefully Hillary Clinton and the rest of her cabal will be brought to justice. Okay, next segment. I told you about the housing problem. Or should we say the collapse of the housing market in the Northeast. 50% sales down. I gave you all sorts of stats. That's in last week's show. I'm not going to repeat them here. Let's just say the Northeast housing market is tanking. The West is down 15%. The Midwest is up 4%. And the Far West is down like 10%. It's beginning, folks. It's beginning. And in my next segment, I'm going to give you facts and figures on the economy and Americans and how you may stand. You can interpolate your own finances in with what I'm going to tell you to see where you stand on a relative basis. And there is cause for concern, if not outright worry. Connecticut is a relatively, or was, a relatively wealthy state. The southwestern part of Connecticut is kind of the suburbs for a lot of high mucky mucks who work in finance and banking and all sorts of industries in New York. Stanford was, 20 years ago, kind of a hub of commercial activities, GTE, all sorts of big companies, 11 Fortune 500 companies, I believe, had moved their headquarters there. New Canaan, Westport, Wilton, Greenwich, you might have heard these names. I mean, high-end residential areas, beautifully wooded, many acre lots. And then there were some poor areas in Connecticut too, Bridgeport, Hartford, you know, the cities. Typical kind of suburban rural versus cities deal. And up to about 30 years ago, Connecticut was prosperous. It was safe. It was growing. It was maintaining its aesthetic integrity and its fiscal integrity. It was under Republican rule. Give or take 30 years ago, the state started to switch left. In part due to left-leaning Jews. For the last 30 years, 25 years, Connecticut has been pretty much ruled by Democrats, with some vestiges of Republican and or conservative legislature, administration, you know, executive offices, and judiciary. However, there's been a decided swing to the left over the last 20 years. And now for the first time, remember what I told you about the Northeast, first time there's been no Republican congressman? Now for the first time, there are super majorities of Democrats in both houses of the state legislature. The Republican gubernatorial candidate, probably through voter fraud, lost narrowly to the Democratic candidate, whose name is Lamont. You have listened and probably puked listening to Blumenthal, the senator from Connecticut, during the Kavanaugh hearings. And I mean, the guy is just, I just can't even stand when he opens his mouth. That's Connecticut today. Ruled lock, stock, and barrel by Democrats. Under Democratic control for at least the last 20 years. It is amongst the most broke states in the country overall. It has one of the biggest unfunded liabilities in terms of pensions. I've given you a number of shows on pensions. Type it in the search bar. Of all. It has seen its real estate values decline from a peak in 2005 or 2006 by somewhere between 30 and 40%, and they have not rebounded like other more vibrant and, shall we say, more conservatively controlled sections of the company. Waterfront places like in Stamford Harbor, Westport along the coast, Long Island Sound, that people bought for $3 million and $3.3 million. I mean, this is a wealthy area. Or at least that portion of Connecticut is wealthy. $3.3 million back between 2000 and 2006 might bring $2 to $2.1 today. And I know some of you are going, oh, well, isn't that too bad? They're only going to get $2 million from their house. Everything is relative, folks. You know, you can be broke and have a net worth of $10,000. You can be broke, have a net worth of $1 million. You can be broke, have a net worth of $10 million. It's all relative, just number zeros. And I'm not trying to create sympathy. Listen, I feel badly for the people of Connecticut. I feel badly for the people in most of the Northeast, with the exception of rural Maine, rural New Hampshire, and rural Vermont. Although Vermont reelected Bernie Sanders. Unbelievable. But this has to do with the growth of government, the growth of government expenditures, the increase in taxation, which drives away people who wish to succeed and companies who need to make a profit, which in turn lowers opportunity and employment opportunity, which in turn decreases tax revenues, which in turn creates situations in which Democratic politicians, left-wing politicians, rather than cutting expenditures, simply increase taxes, which increases the whole downward spiral and accelerates it. So New Canaan, Connecticut is a very wealthy community. It is one of the communities where the new tax law took a bite out of people and out of real estate. You know, SALT, S-A-L-T, property taxes, it's called SALT. And where SALT is high property taxes and high income taxes, and Connecticut has both because of Democratic rule and the downward spiral I just described to you. Under the new tax law, you can only write off $10,000. I've told you before, there are people around the country, the higher end of Illinois, California, certain parts of the Northeast around Boston, Connecticut, New Jersey, Rhode Island, where people pay incredibly high property taxes. I mean, that waterfront house that I used just as an example, their property taxes, this is a couple of acres, in a house that has declined in value by 30%. Their property taxes are like $70,000 per year. Think about that. $70,000 a year in property taxes. And on top of that, you have the state income tax. And if you work in New York, New York tries to tax you on that income. And many areas of New York around the city to the north have the same exact problems as I'm describing in Connecticut. So you've been hit with a double whammy, and it all contributes to this downward spiral. And what's going to happen is these wealthy communities in Connecticut. This is actually an article that I found on Connecticut. This gentleman's name is Chris DeMuth Jr. It was published November 10th, in fact, in the New Canaan newspaper, which I'm sure the New Canaan realtors weren't too happy about. Let me tell you, let me give you the first paragraph in the article. Congratulations to Connecticut Democrats on their trifecta in Hartford. Our new Democratic governor will be utterly unconstrained by Republicans in any position of authority. In fact, any effective pressure on Governor-elect Ned Lamont will all come from his left. Progressive voices in both the upper and lower chambers are now a majority of the majority party. And he goes on to talk about how this is going to occur. This is going to result in yet another property tax hike, and yet another income tax hike, a hike in the top marginal rate for state taxes, and an acceleration of businesses and taxpayers fleeing Connecticut for states that want them. And by the way, what's going to happen to housing values? Well, they're going to continue to go down, aren't they? You're going to have an increasing inventory and a decreasing pool of buyers. Never mind the increase in interest rates. Never mind affordability. Never mind property taxes that can't be written off on federal. I mean, you know, the list is pretty dismal. I'm going to read you two paragraphs from this article, and then you will understand why the Northeast, folks, is down 50% in housing sales, because the articles I am reading to you, or the two paragraphs I'm about to read to you from the Moose article about one little town in one state in the Northeast, is apropos to many areas of Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey, and the entire Northeast corridor, particularly Massachusetts and Connecticut. And it's going to happen to them all. And it is happening, which is why the sales are down. It's exactly why sales are going to be hurt in Colorado, a state that has gone progressively blue. I don't even think Colorado's purple anymore, other than the West Slope. I'm quoting from the article now. While our taxes and liabilities are heading in one direction, our state benefits will head in another. Tax revenues that had gone to Connecticut's economically functional towns will be redirected to Connecticut's economically dysfunctional cities. This will cost us dearly in direct costs, but will prove to be doubly expensive as redeployed funds will stymie the need for reforms that otherwise would save our cities from their self-imposed insolvencies. In particular, we will buy out $550 million of Bridgeport and Stamford debt. The lesson is clear. The more you spend, the more bailout money you get. The more revenue a town can raise, the more they will take. Think of the $550 million as a down payment. These bailouts will continue until they run out of our money. In short, we are about to see a lot of our wealth redistributed among the people, businesses, and towns that earn it to pay for the state's government unlimited appetite to spend it on those who do not. And that, folks, is why the Northeast is down so much more than other areas and is the first to go. And those of you listening to me around the country in similar situations, brace yourself. Now let me go to the next segment, which is stats. These are scary stats standing on their own. They will also give you a feel on how you fit in with most Americans, because I don't think most Americans have a good feel for how they fit in with most other Americans. I think it is important for you to know where you kind of fit in relative to stuff. I think it's critical you know these stats. And by the way, these stats will also tie into the other things that I've talked about this show and others. Because if something happens of calamitous nature in the economy, if people's housing values go down, and they've unfortunately taken out, you know, high percentage mortgages or floating rate mortgages in a period of interest rates on the incline, or have taken out, God forbid, second mortgages on their houses, HELOCs. There's going to be a lot of desperate people out there. Remember the mantra of the left, never let a crisis go to waste. Couple that with the fact that the 37 or whatever it is, new members of Congress are virtually all national socialist Democrats, self-proclaimed, proudly. Couple that with the left swing of the Democratic Party. Couple that with Barack Obama, Maxine Waters, and others' view on reparations and the racial divide they are creating. Couple that with what's going on, what has gone on in Zimbabwe, Rhodesia, and what's going on right now in South Africa. Couple that with the change in demographics because of illegal immigration, also foisted by the left. There's a lot of dots that are starting to coalesce, folks. A lot of dots. All right, let me give you these stats because they are fascinating. The average of savings accounts, and by the way, this is from a combination of articles. I did a lot of research on this because it's important and it plays into a long-term, high-risk scenario. I'm going to talk about it next week. The average savings account balance in the United States was $5,923 in 2011. This is by Pitney Bowes, a study by Pitney Bowes. New Mexico had the lowest, 4,100. I'm going to round numbers for you, 4,100. New Jersey had the highest, 7,800. Remember that this is average, folks. So that means that there are a whole bunch of people out there who had nothing. And a whole bunch of people who had more. This is just the average for all Americans. Bank rate, a 2012 report. 28% of American families have no, that's zero, nada, savings. 20% don't have enough saved to cover 3 months of living expenses. 20% of the population. Just 43% have enough in savings to cover 3 months of expenses. Unbelievable. Chicago Tribune, the average 401k balance is around $74,600 in 2012. The average account for those over 50 is $130,000. USA Today, half, 50% of all U.S. retirees have less than $25,000 in savings of any type, any kind, retirement or otherwise. Half of American households have no retirement accounts at all. No 401ks, no IRAs, nothing. Some of these are expecting pension income. I've done shows on the pension problem. I just talked about Connecticut, which is billions of dollars underwater, a little state, and Illinois, and California, tens of billions underwater. Where do you think that $120 trillion to $200 trillion in unfunded liabilities comes from? That's right, Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, and pensions. 29%, Government Accountability Office, GAO, 29% of households age 55 or older have neither a retirement savings or a pension. Wow. What is the average, you might be asking? National Institute on Retirement Security. 40 million households have no retirement savings at all. Employee Benefit Research Institute. They estimate Americans have a retirement savings deficit, listen to this, of $4.3 trillion, that's trillion dollars, trillion, not B, T, trillion, a savings deficit of $4.3 trillion. All U.S. households that would be ahead of household between the ages of 25 and 64, therefore have saved $4.3 trillion less than they should have saved for at least a comfortable, we're not talking about lavish, a comfortable lifestyle. Net worth. You might find this interesting. Hopefully all of you know at least roughly what your net worth is. Net worth, excluding your equity in your home, for Americans 35 to 44 years old, this is Census Bureau, by the way, is $14,226. I want you to think about that. You're 35 to 44 years old, putting aside your house, your net worth is under $15,000. I find that just mind-boggling. In the 55 to 64 year old age range, the average net worth is still a mind-boggling $45,447. Wow. So you are 55 to 64 years old. You have worked for 30 or 40 years. You may or may not, chances are 50% you don't, have a retirement savings account. You may or may not be one of the lucky few that at least has a little bit of money in savings, not much. You may or may not be the part of the unfortunate folks who are relying on a pension, which is unlikely to be paid in full, if at all. And after working all that time, putting aside your house, that may be a big equity in that, your entire net worth is $45,000. You know, you read these stats, and I think you understand why people are concerned and they are pissed. Social Security benefits. The average Social Security benefit that these people are going to get or receive is $1,354.04 as of October 2016. So if you are in that, give or take, 50 to 60% of older Americans who have no more than $25,000 in savings, no retirement account, many of you having no pension, and any of you having a pension have to be worried about it, you're going to live on $1,300 a month, your Social Security? Wow. That's all I can say is wow. Folks that are at the top of the economic heap, is really interesting doing this, putting this together. They still have huge savings gaps. I mean, people are making $300,000 a year, have huge savings gaps. Remember what I said at the beginning of the segment? It's just a question of zeros. Well, the folks at the top of the income heap, okay, we've been talking about most Americans in the middle or the bottom of the income heap, you know, they have expensive mortgages. Our talk about Connecticut. Their kids are in private school. You know, they take vacation. Look, I'm not saying these aren't bad choices or good choices or whatever. I'm just saying that people who make a lot of money spend a lot more money. The end result, here's the money I made and here's the money I spent and this is what's left, is not too different across all sectors of the economy. And we'll call it the social classes. Let me give you 23 quick facts just to kind of tie this all up in a bow for you. I think if your eyes aren't bugging out of your head with these stats right now, they will be at the end of these 23 additional facts. The number of Americans who have no cash in the bank whatsoever is 26%. More than a quarter of this country has zero cash in the bank. Another 36% have 3 months' worth of emergency expenditures in the bank, which isn't much, but they have not started saving for retirement at all. Zero. Nada. Right there, folks, is 60% of the population with a serious financial problem, either current or future or a combination of the two. What is the average bank account balance? This was an updated study to the one I gave you. 2013, average bank account balance $4,436. What is the personal savings rate in the United States? Savings rate is the average amount of earnings, just so we are all on the same page here. Amount of earnings by folks in the United States that people are putting away for rainy days. In 2014, the rate was 4.4% of income was being salted away. In 2012, it was 10.5%. That's not a good trend line. Do you remember earlier in the show I talked about the on-the-street interviews by Raymond Arroyo and how 8 out of 10 of the people he interviewed said, oh yeah, I'm not going to hold back, I'm going to splurge? It all kind of ties in, doesn't it? How many adults live paycheck to paycheck? 38 million households, folks. 38 million households. Household, I believe, is defined still as an average of 2.3 people. 70 to 80 million people, 38 million households, live hand to mouth. Every penny they get from their paychecks goes to an expense. They save nothing. They have nothing. Even though two-thirds of those families earn a median income of $41,000, which is above the federal poverty level. 7.7% of American households function with no bank account. That's 10 million households, folks. There's 10 million households out there that don't even have a bank account. Now, I'm sure some of them just do cash. You know, good for them. But I'm sure many of them don't have a bank account for a whole bunch of other less inspiring reasons. Does race, you know, we always hear about the racist this and the racist that, misogyny, whatever, the usual litany of crap from the left. It is true, however, racial minorities have a tougher road. 75% of Latino and African American households have less than $10,000 saved for retirement. Now, that's pretty rapidly changing under Trump's policies with low Latino and black unemployment and other things, but it has a long ways to go. 75%, less than $10,000 saved for retirement. Two-thirds of minority households have nothing set aside for the future, nothing. Baby boomers, let's get into age. Baby boomers do the best at hanging on to money. Adults age 55 and older have a positive personal savings rate of 13%, the highest of any of the demographics. Millennials are the worst, the lowest of any of the demographics. That means adults who are 35 and under, remember how they're voting, folks. 37% didn't show up, and 64% of those that did voted left-wing, socialist. Don't think that doesn't have something to do with these stats that I'm giving you. And remember, these are the people who 10 and 20 and 30 years from now will be running this country. This is the generation that now outnumbers the baby boomers. Millennials have a personal savings rate of negative, underline the word negative, 2%. They spend 2% more than they take in. Baby boomers save 13%. Millennials spend 2% more than they take in. Gimme, gimme, gimme. And you know, haves and have-nots. And one thing you can always rely on in life and human nature is that, with very few exceptions, the have-nots always want what the haves have. Almost always. Cities. The easiest city to save in, believe it or not, is Baltimore. Median household income, $73,800. Median expenses, $49,500. One of the worst cities to save in, Phoenix. Median expenses in Phoenix are $1,136 higher than the median annual income. In other words, living expenses are higher than the median annual income. Maybe we start understanding why Sinema got enough votes so that fraud could help her get over the top. Because, you know, in my mind, I'm still shaking my head over that election. And if you've listened to me last couple months, there is no way in a sane America that Sonnema could have beat McSally. There is no way. Except maybe what I'm telling you here. Half of Americans, listen to this one. Hold on to your seat. Half of Americans would not be able to cover an unexpected expense of $500 or less. 50% of our fellow countrymen could not withstand an emergency of $500 or less, folks. A quarter of our fellow countrymen would not be able to cover an emergency of $100 or less. 22.9% of men and 22.7% of women say they don't have at least $100 in their emergency fund. I find that those statistics, those numbers, those facts absolutely petrifying and mind-boggling. 41% of all adults have less than $500 in the bank. 41% of all adults. There's about 200 million, give or take, quote-unquote, adults in the United States, 220 million. Somewhere between 70 and 80 million people in the United States don't have $500 in the bank. 3 months' worth of expenses. I mean, the very bare minimum emergency fund anybody should have, because anything can happen. You could break your leg. You could have a car accident. You know, you could get laid off. You could get fired. You could, who knows? I mean, life is life. Crap happens. 3 months minimum living expenses you should always have in the bank, your emergency fund. 17% of Americans have 3 months emergency reserve in the bank. 3 to 5 months, to be exact. 17%. Less than one in five, folks. Less than one in five. Only 23% of adults have an emergency fund that could last 6 months. That's really where you want to shoot for. 6 month emergency fund. Just 23%. If you look at the age and demographic breakdown again of these various stats, it tells you another story. It reinforces the story. Age, income, and race play a part. They do. 36% of retirees have a 6 month emergency account. Only 16% of 18 to 29 year olds do. 10% of college graduates lack any savings. 36% of those with a high school diploma or less lack any savings. I mean, there is a palpable difference that these stats are telling us. Social Security, folks, is projected to decline to about 75% of current payments for a whole bunch of reasons. Depending upon how much they hate us, the politicians are unlikely, probably, who knows, to change the payments currently going out. So we're talking about a decrease of 25% in future payments to future recipients, which exacerbates this whole statistical picture I'm giving you. Scary statistical picture. 36% of adults have not started saving for retirement. A quarter of all adults from 50 to 64 years old are not saving anything. They still aren't saving. 25% of people nearing retirement, quote-unquote age, are not saving anything yet. There's a number of studies that say if you're a middle-class person, a middle-class worker with a middle-class type of lifestyle, I mean, nothing extravagant at all, you will need, and given life expectancy increases, which also exacerbates things, you will likely need about $250,000 of some type of savings, pension, you name it, income, for retirement. $250,000 minimum. If you want to build up $250,000 in savings, let's put this in the other context, coming from the other direction. If you want to save up $250,000 in savings, divide it, folks, by the number of months you have left to work between now and your planned retirement, whenever that is, 65, 70, 75, whatever. There's no set number as to what year or age you retire at anymore. And divide $250,000 by that number. Actually, subtract out whatever savings you hopefully have from that number. Divide that by the number of months, and that tells you what you need to save per month. That's pretty simple. And you'll do even better if you're putting it in compound interest investments of a safe nature to boot. On average, however, and unfortunately, workers that are aged 30 to 49, that 19-year spread, are saving $200 a month for retirement. Multiply that out. Doesn't come anywhere near $250,000. Those aged 50 to 59 are only adding $78. Did you hear what I just said? Those that are nearest retirement are only on the average adding $78 to their accounts every month. Wow. I mean, that's just the story with a bad ending. In 2013, the average 401k was $101,650. The median balance, right, the mid-level, the average is you add them all together, you divide by the number of accounts, that gives you an average. Median means the median point of the highest and the lowest. That was just $31,396. Basically, what that means is half of the workers participating in employers' retirement, 401ks, had that much or more, and the other half had less, to make it real simple. 93% of middle-class workers are participating to a 401k plan. That's good. 67% are only saving enough to qualify for the company match. That's not so good. The median contribution amount for those between the ages of 30 and 59 years of age, 30-year spread, is 7% of their salary. That's per year, folks. That's per year. What's the median net worth? You'll find this fascinating. This is an updated study from what I gave you before. Seniors age 55 to 64, the median net worth has now increased, a lot of it due to the stock market gains, etc., over the past few years, to $165,000, which, by the way, I still find remarkably low. Those in the 35 to 44-year-old range now boast a net worth of $50,000. The 18 to 34-year-old millennial set, remember how they voted, folks, has an average net worth of $11,000. Can you imagine being 33 or 34 years old and having a net worth of $11,000? Against this, juxtapose the number one financial concern for 59% of Americans. I mean, 60% of the country. The number one financial concern. That is running out of money in retirement. Somehow all those stats just wow. To tell you how people's minds have changed, and I'm gonna finish this segment up with this factoid, if you will. In 2013, 7% of employees said they planned to stay on the job indefinitely. Only 2% thought so in 2011. Now, 7% is not a lot, but 2% to 7% is a 300% increase. Something tells me we're going to see it even more. By the way, these facts and stats were compiled. I gave you some of the sources at the beginning of the segment, but they were also compiled from Gallup, the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, Bankrate, Interest.com, Vanguard, the National Institute on Retirement Security, the Washington Post, the FDIC, the Brookings Institute, the Wall Street Journal, Credit Donkey, the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and Towers Watson. So this isn't some left or right or some outfit with an axe to grind. These numbers have been compiled from a wide range of many fairly astute sources. Next week, we're going to talk about what these numbers mean politically. what these numbers mean for your freedoms, for the Second Amendment, for voting rights, for the Constitution. In the meantime, hopefully you found those stats as fascinating as I did and as worrisome as I did. And now we're going to end with the final segment because it ties it all in. Barack Obama. Barack Obama. Not the top financial cheese, that's George Soros. We're going to talk more about him next week, too. Because, by the way, did you know that left-leaning Jews say that if you get on George Soros, many of them, not all, then you are being anti-Semitic? Obviously, they don't know George's history as well as my listeners do. So here's Barack Obama, the 2018 Nelson Mandela Annual Lecture. Understand that in South Africa, Rhodesia and Zimbabwe, and in South Africa right now, as I broadcast this show, there is killings and tortures and rapes going on of non-black minorities. Their lands and their properties are being taken without compensation, and they're being redistributed to all black majorities in return for votes. And in the name, in the guise of social justice. I've done a whole, I think one of the better ones that media has done, show on this. Just type reparations into the search bar. Many of our politicians, Maxine Waters most notably, have said so much that they don't oppose, and some have said they are in favor of reparations. We are all familiar of the racial tensions that have been stoked quite purposely by the left. I mean, if you breathe and don't think like they do, you are a racist. If you voted for Donald Trump, all 65 or 70 million of us were racist. If you are part of the 70% of Americans that want stricter border control, you are a racist. If you wanna, I don't want to say have fun. If you want to satiate your curiosity, you might want to go to Google and see what politicians were saying about racism in Rhodesia, Zimbabwe, and South Africa. Which, by the way, some of those countries did have an apartheid problem. I'm not trying to downplay that, but see the rhetoric prior to the genocides, and that's what they are. The change in constitution, the change in government and components of the government, the rise of left-wing factions, and the reparations, takings without due process. Well, Barack Obama called this and called the president of South Africa, Cyril Ramaphosa. Listen to my show on reparations. He praised him in this speech. You ought to read the whole speech. It'll curl your hair. He praised Ramaphosa in his speech for, quote, inspiring new hope in this country. Huh. This is a country with its economy in a tailspin since it is booting out, killing off, and taking from its productive classes. A country in the throes of, if there's such a thing, mild genocide. A country who has conformed itself to Marxist ideology and unilaterally, through democracy, changed its constitution. And a country which is taking from the haves and giving to the have-nots to increase the power of those in charge of the transfer of wealth. Barack Obama said, quote, inspiring new hope in this country. He also said, rather remarkably, he also said that, and by the way, let me give you a little background. So Barack Obama, who talks about the common man and social justice and all this kind of stuff, Barack Obama pretty much came to Washington, D.C. with not much, basically nothing. And right now his net worth is estimated at $40 million. He lives in an $8.1 million home in the Calamara section of Washington, D.C., and he has inked deals recently, Netflix, a bunch of other globalist elites that will pay him upwards of $250 million, $250 million over the near future. By the near future, I mean 2 to 4 years. This is the guy who is calling Ramaphosa inspiring. Let me give you another little tidbit from his speech in South Africa. Quote, where globalization means, as it so often does, that the rich and the powerful now have new means to further enrich and empower themselves at the cost of the poor and the weaker, then we have a responsibility to protest in the name of universal freedom. I guess that means taking from the haves, unless it's you, Mr. Obama, and giving to the have-nots. You know, what Barack Obama really is, folks, reading his speech in South Africa and being familiar with his lies, his policies, his true beliefs, having read his book, Barack Obama is really the modern-day carpetbagger. That's really what he is. He's a carpetbagger. He's a carpetbagger just like those white folks that he hates that truly did profit enormously and should have been hung from trees. These are white folks during the Reconstruction period following the Civil War. Unfortunately, because of Lincoln's assassination at the hands of an alt-left lunatic, John Wilkes Booth. Well, look, Obama, I just gave you his net worth. I gave you his $250 billion, $250 million he's expecting in the next 4 years, and all the crap. Here's another part of his speech. You'll love this. There's only so much you can eat. There's only so big a house you can have. There's only so many nice trips you can take. I mean, it's enough. Okay. Thanks, Barry. You set such a great example. Anyway, he said other things in this speech too, which you don't even have to read behind the lines. All you have to do is, I gave you just a few samples. All you have to do is read the speech, understand the English language, and know that Barack Obama, who is the titular head of the Democratic Party, is for racial division and is for, without a doubt, reparations and is for redistribution and is for government and globalization control and is against individual freedoms and liberties. And that, folks, is what got elected to the House of Representatives. Lots more next week. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. Have a great week.
Please remember, if you've missed any shows, just click on Show Archive and you'll find all of his shows. We look forward to seeing you here again next week for another episode of Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side.